This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to PTPN's NBA Team Podcast. I am one of your co-hosts, Andrew Reich. I am joined by my co-host, Adam Murray. How you doing?
I am not too bad. It's just, everything has just been sort of the same.
Yeah.
Teams are falling fast, who are still falling, teams are rising, who was before. And
yeah, because we're 2 weeks removed now from the trade deadline, and we did our season recap. Or, you know, our up-to-date recap. Last week, it feels like kind of a little more of the same this past week. There's a few things, obviously, we're going to be hitting on. We're not going to be talking about Seinfeld or 90s music or any other stupid random thing like that. We actually have things to talk about in the NBA goings-on. Even though it didn't feel like there was too much traction, it feels like the standings are still the same with Atlanta on top. They got a big win against Cleveland at home. Chicago's moving back up, even though Derrick Rose is missing. Golden State is still great. Memphis is still great. There's been a little bit of movement, but, you know, outside of that, you know, how surprised – let me start with this one because I just noticed this one. How surprised are you with Indiana getting back into the race?
Well, we predicted they'd get hot. It was the, you know, the Paul George coming back, and they want to make a run. So it comes as no surprise that, they could be still six games below 500 and then sneak into the seventh place. And, you know, the sad thing is the way Milwaukee, Washington, and Toronto are playing, I wouldn't be surprised if Indiana catches up the way they're playing.
Unbelievably, Washington and Milwaukee are only separated by a game and a half. And Milwaukee is only five games ahead of Indiana, which would put Washington, I'm trying to do the numbers here. That would make them five and a half games ahead or six and a half.
Six and a half ahead, but you know, Washington has been terrible.
I know it's hard to explain. You know, they won one, but they've lost eight of their last 10. You know, their offense is in the shitter. Their offense has been bad all year. Their defense is really good, but their defense has been giving up more points than they did recently. They did beat the Miami Heat in a home game that they desperately needed, but they haven't looked great. Toronto hasn't really looked good at all. I can't really figure them out either. And Milwaukee with Michael Carter-Williams is still a work in progress, to say the least. It's almost like they're starting over again. It's like, okay, you figured this out. Now you're going to have to do this again, but you only have 2 months instead of 6 months.
Well, basically, Brendan Knight was running the team. It wasn't just he was a part of the machine. It was everything seemed to be funneling through him, and you take him out, and they just took a major step back, and it was sort of one of those, like, huh, why?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Carter Williams, like, he's starting to – you could see the slow improvement. Like, okay, don't just chuck it up every time you get it. But
yeah,
it's really – I don't know whether – maybe just, you know, you get sort of deluded with that. We actually have expectations for that team now.
Yeah, it's weird. It's like, okay, now we think you're going to be good, so you have to be good now. It's like, no, this takes time. You know, it's not something that happens overnight like a microwave. And, you know, they obviously suffered the injury early in the year to Jabari Parker. Their defenses, they've been hanging their hat on, and Carter Williams does help them on the defensive end most of the time. So that's a bit of an advantage. But on the offensive end, they've tumbled even more than they were at the beginning of the season when they were mediocre at best. Now they're just bad.
Yeah, it's like, well, you know, don't forget, there was no real, like, shopping around of Brendan Knight. Nobody knew he was on the trading block. It just sort of came out of nowhere. That and with Larry Sanders' retirement, the locker room sort of has to be confused, I would think.
Yeah, and Miami's hanging on. Indiana's making their push, like we saw, like we said. We don't know about Paul George. There's rumors that he might get shut down. Paul George wants to play, but I don't know if it's even his decision at this point. Charlotte's right there. They're tied with Miami, even though Miami owns the tiebreaker there for now. Your Boston Celtics are tied with Brooklyn, only 2 games back. So it's still a hodgepodge. It seems like Detroit is starting to fall out, though.
Yeah, Detroit, they, you know, with the Reggie Jackson coming in.
Is it too early to say the Reggie Jackson trade's backfiring?
No, because point guard is the toughest position to come in and sort of change the style you're used to. Like, if you're just a big man, all right, I know I could do pick and roll. I could do, you know, the pick and pop, whatever you need me to do. But if you're the point guard, you have a totally new system. But just going back to Miami and speaking of hodgepodge, how about that team now with – which is Bill Walker and...
Oh, no, his name's not Bill Walker anymore.
Or Henry Walker. is it Tyler Johnson or something?
Yeah, who's like he's like a perennial 10-day contract guy. He's a guy who's been around for a long time. I remember he played for the Pelicans a couple of times, and I just saw him pop up all of a sudden. It's like, whoa, you know? Whiteside's still doing his thing. You know, he had another big outing, I think, about...
I saw Michael Beasley returned, and...
Beasley's back. He took the game-winning shot, or the potential game-losing shot, I guess, against the Wizards, which shocked me. And you got Charlotte there. They're starting to turn a corner. They've won 4 games in a row, even though they're still out of the playoffs. Kemba Walker's going to be coming back sometime soon. I still think that Mo Williams' deal really saved them, because it gave him a scorer to replace Walker, because it seems like Lance isn't a scorer. Lance is a dirty defensive type of guy.
Well, right now Lance isn't doing much, but the team just has no bench, because all they have is just their horrible draft picks and... You know, whatever happened to Noah Vonleh? Wasn't he supposed to be good? And
yeah, Vonleh has done nothing. Zeller's done okay. Michael Kidd-Gilchrist is doing a lot better on the offensive end. It feels like he's starting to sort of turn a corner as an offensive player, because defensively, I think he's I say that, and we always talk about how he was the guy guarding Carmelo when he scored 60 points or something, and then he guarded LeBron with the mask and he scored 61 on him. So I don't know how good he really is defensively, but it seemed like that was his strength when he came into the NBA, but offensively, he's getting better.
Oh, yeah, especially if you have no offense and your defense is okay, you're a defensive specialist. We'll give you something to hang your hat on, like Bismack Biyombo, who really just can't do anything. But, oh, he's totally a defensive shot, but he's the next Serge Ibaka.
And speaking of guys that were wearing masks while going off on the other team, let's talk a little bit about Russell Westbrook, shall we?
He's just doing what he's doing. He's trying to will that team to do something, and I don't know about him.
Well, you say you don't know about him, but if you look at the numbers, or if you're like, say, a fantasy guy, you know, you look at the numbers and he's your hero. He's your everything. You know, in the absence of Durant, the fact that Ibaka has not really stepped up at all in the second half of the season, Westbrook has just been going on an absolute flamethrower tear. Let's see where he's been at. Now these are losses, okay? Thursday, the 26th of February, they were at Phoenix. They lost 39 points, 14 rebounds, 11 assists. That was actually his second triple-double in a row. Then at Portland on TNT, that was the one where he got the dent in his face and he had to get facial surgery. 40 points, 13 rebounds, 11 assists, but they lost by 3 in a close game. Took the night against the Lakers, and then he came back against the Philadelphia 76ers this past week on Wednesday. OMG, 49 points, 15 rebounds, 10 assists, including this one highlight where he went 94 feet from the basket on a tear dunk. I mean, this thing was crazy.
Yeah, I saw it. Like I said, the thing I don't get about him is that, you know, they're losing those close games, and, you know, he's just going Kobe on everybody. There's 4 other people on the court. Is him being on a tear necessarily making everyone else better? No, it's just they're just all sitting there watching him.
They had to go to overtime to beat the Sixers. That was the one game that they won outside of the Lakers game that he didn't play. Then on Thursday night on TNT, he went to Chicago, and they lost on a 3-pointer by, of all people, Etuan Moore. Even though he scored 43 points, but his triple-double streak was broken because he only, quote-unquote, got 8 rebounds and 7 assists. But let's continue your point about of Russell kind of taking alpha male mode. you talk about Kobe Bryant, and it kind of reminds me of those games or those stretches with the Lakers where Shaq would take time off. And Kobe would come in, and this particularly happened in 2003. Kobe went on an absolute tear. He went like 7 games or 8 games in a row with 40 points or more. It seemed like he was sort of taking the mantle a little bit as the lead guy in Lakerland. But then when Shaq came back, it was Shaq's team again, and it seemed like the chemistry wasn't there. Do you think there is a scare that that could happen between Russell and Kevin Durant?
Well, if you listen to them, they act like they're all BFFs, and they all just, you know, they're, hi, neighbor, we all live, you know, we all carpool together, and we're all super buddies. But, like I said, you know, like I said, it's just, that's why I don't get it, is I saw him just, you know, be in beast mode all week, but you're not doing anything for your teammates. They're just watching, and I'm watching them. They're just sort of standing there. Like, they're not running their plays. Like, oh, well, we know he'll score 50. We know he's going to go off. So why should we bother trying?
Well, I think that's more of a damning of the bench and the role players because of the fact that Russell – I don't think it's that Russell doesn't trust them. I mean, yet in order to get a triple-double, you need to get more than 10 assists. So he definitely trusts them to make plays. But, you know – it's hard to say this with the given the streak he's on, but do you feel like there are some guys, some star players that go out of their way to share the ball? They almost try to force it.
Oh, like LeBron a couple years ago.
Yeah, or like
early
Kobe.
Miami, like, dude, just take the shot. Don't
you remember when Kobe did that in Game 7 against the Suns back in 06, where he just said, I'm not taking any shots. I'm going to show everybody how bad my teammates are.
Yeah, but that's very, you know, I don't think it's a passive-aggressive way of just calling out his teammates, but it's just nobody's doing anything else on that team right now but him, and that's the, you know, we could say the injuries, and they've been, you know, they haven't had, like, hardly any time together, but there's a reason they're just in eighth place, and they play like they're in eighth place.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I guess they're just, you know, when you're hot, just be hot. And
let's say this. Kevin Durant's out. Like, let's say there's an announcement. Kevin Durant's going to sit the rest of the season. Would you still consider them, like, would you put them in that eighth spot? And if they were, would they still be a dangerous team for whoever they would play against, whether it be a one seed or a two seed, just because of Westbrook?
No. Yes, they will make the eighth seed. Who's going to beat them? New Orleans? With their roving injury gang. It's like volleyball. You just have to tag somebody out and okay, you're gonna sit for next week with an injury. All right, Tyreek, you're out. Eric Gordon, you're back in. They have no, you know, Norris Cole seems to be like your all-star backcourt guy.
I really like Norris Cole, which is funny because I hated him in Miami because he would always take these really unconventional, badly timed shots. I didn't like how he defensively not very good, but I don't think he's asked to play defense in New Orleans. I think he's come in. He knows I've got to score off the bench to relieve Tyreek or Eric Gordon if Eric Gordon's not making shots. And I think Cole's really worked out. I think, like we already talked about Mo Williams a little bit. You know, we talked ad nauseum about Isaiah Thomas with the Boston Celtics. I feel like some of those kind of like little smaller deals, those side deals that got made, some of them are paying off really nicely. It hasn't paid off right now with Oklahoma City.
No. It's, you know, when everyone was praising, you know, Sam Presti for that, I was like, you know, at no point should anybody say Enes Kanter is the missing piece.
Yeah, he played okay in the Chicago game, but he still lost.
He seems to be playing, to me, the same way he was just playing in Utah. He's giving you what he gives you, and that's it.
He's just there.
Yeah, he's not changing his game up. He's just like, all right, I'm here. I'll fit in. I'll get my 16 and 8 or whatever.
Yeah.
But he's not, you know, the team is just, you know, with him and just, you know, Deion Waiters come in, you're dynamic and, you know, I guess it was just the malcontent Reggie Jackson was, and mm-hmm. he was just unhappy every day. There's more going on back there in the locker room than they're letting on. They're just trying to will themselves, like, oh, everything's fine. We'll make the playoffs. We'll be good. Everything's wonderful. Yeah.
Let's do a what-if game, and we'll go back to probably the most famous trade of our era here in this current era of the NBA, and that's the James Harden trade. Say it doesn't happen, and in some stupid scenario, Russell Westbrook walks in free agency or whatnot. if James Harden was in that role filling in for Durant, kind of in the same way he's filling in for Dwight Howard in Houston, do you think the team would be much more successful with James Harden being the lead guy instead of Westbrook being the lead guy? Basically, what I'm saying is, who's a better alpha male in terms of being a guy who can play a sidekick but have to step in as a go-to guy, Harden or Westbrook?
This will be the unpopular just party line answer, but I think it just comes down to the system that Harden is thriving the way that his team is set up with no point guard, nobody but him to run it, and you just have big men he can just, you know, run through the entire time. Mm-hmm. If he was on Oklahoma City, I can't see him pulling off that same stuff that really Russell Westbrook is doing. Because Harden, I think, would just be jacking up threes all day and try to go for some three-point record.
Isn't that what Russell Westbrook does, too?
No, but Russell's still plowing into people and, you know, going to the basket. I just see, I could just see Harden becoming more of a jump shooter than he is. Because Russell's just is like, he's just sort of like a football player right now. He's like, I'm just going to barrel into you. If I'm going to take a shot, I'm going to take a shot.
He's got that scat back personality. Like, I'm just going to go right to the hole and I'm gonna do what I've got to do. Whereas Harden likes to trick you. You know, he likes to go hard at you with the dribbles and the pump fakes and the crossovers. But when it comes down to it, James Harden's really a jump shooter. He's great at finishing at the rim, no doubt. But really, his go-to is that money shot off of that crossover and step back. He's got that mastered. Russell, with all the highlights, with the All-Star MVP, with all the crazy dunks, all the flashy stuff that people know Russ for, the thing that I think makes him so dangerous, he's such a good mid-range shooter.
Because that's just becoming a lost art form right now.
Yeah, but he's really good at it. It's almost like he's launching it. I think he goes so quickly off the dribble that when he stops for the mid-range, it's almost like he's leaning in because his body movement is so fast. It's almost like he's about to fall on his face, but he always makes those shots. I mean, well, he makes most of them. He had one game against the Suns where he went 12 for 38. That's a little bit much, but there are those nights like against Philadelphia where he's just making everything.
Yeah. Okay. Just to, to sort of answer your question, who would you rather have if Durant goes out, you still have Perkins and Ibaka sitting there? Or would you rather have,
well, Perkins is gone.
I'm saying before, in this hypothetical, that trade wouldn't have happened. They wouldn't have blown up the team as much as they did. Okay. Or would you rather have Terrence Jones and Monte Yunus? With, because Howard went down, they're not playing the same. They're not just opposite wings of each other. This a big man. So you're, it's really saying, would you rather have Jones and Monte Yunus or Perkins Ibaka?
I would still rather Perkins Ibaka, but to go even further back, I would have just let Ibaka walk and just gone with the two stars in the backcourt with Durant. Now, I say that, with hindsight being 2020, but do you think Westbrook and Harden could have coexisted? It would have been difficult.
They would just be small ball. And small ball isn't going to work. They could have coexisted. All three could have been on the court at the same time. They just would have been deadly. It's like saying, Clay Thompson, Curry can't coexist, or just have two shooters coexist and have a third guy come in. Mm-hmm. You can have that, but just you're now playing small ball the entire time to have those three guys out.
Small ball can work. It happened with LeBron in Miami, but that's because the best player on the court was a small forward who has guard skills and can play the big man role as a fill-in. And then you also had Bosch, who was kind of a power forward. Kevin Durant's not a power forward.
He would have to be in that scenario.
Yeah, he'd basically be like a new version of Adrian Dantley. He'd be up on the block getting his points instead of popping for threes as much, because Harden and Westbrook would be taking most of those.
Yeah, and there's no way he's going to be on the block for long. He will quickly become the stretchiest of stretch fours.
He's the tarantula. He likes to stretch it out. So, I just like to play that game a little bit just to see how you felt. It's not like the James Harden trade, they had to do it, but they were a little bit forced by the cap to do so, especially given that Westbrook is deserving of a max deal alongside Durant. But it doesn't seem like – people like to say, oh, well, they would have won a title by now. I'm not so sure about that. I think that they would have had some trouble anyway with Harden as the third wheel, because sometimes – And you know this better than anyone, given that you've seen this in Boston with a couple of guys that won titles there. Sometimes you need a change of scenery, whether it is increased production or decreased production, in order to really find out what your value is.
Well, there's no way for it. He could never have been the man. He would always be the third wheel of the third wheels.
Mm-hmm.
And you could say, okay, they wouldn't have won a championship, but the thing you forget is the playoffs, the game slows down a ton in the playoffs.
Well, the fourth quarter does.
It becomes just a grind. You're not going to – there's no, run and gun the entire playoffs from, first round all the way to the finals. As each round goes, it's now slower and slower and slower. And I don't, again, with having to run small ball the entire time, and that's just small ball. Mm-hmm. And you're relying on Steven Adams to be some defensive wonder kid now.
Mm-hmm.
You could say, okay, they're not built for a championship because they have no bench either.
Yeah.
You're relying on three guys and three guys only. And, look at last year.
It worked in Miami, though.
But they had a bench.
Slight bench. Guys that would take minimum because they wanted to win there.
Yeah, exactly. Those are just higher guns. But you had, Birdman and Udonis Haslem, who were there to provide solid
toughness.
Yes.
Yes.
Jeremy Lamb isn't going to provide you anything. Perry Jones has just, he's not giving you quality. He'll give you what, a jumper or two?
That's a good point, because the idea that Sam Presti had was to draft these guys using the picks he got from the Harden deal and also some other ancillary deals that he had before that when they were moving from Seattle to Oklahoma City. They stocked up a lot of draft picks, and they made a lot of good draft picks, guys like Harden, Westbrook, Serge Ibaka, even before that when he inherited Nick Collison. But there is a point where what's the best option? Do you draft guys and try to learn how to toughen them up in your system, or do you just go out in the open market and you find guys that you know can provide you that veteranship? And Miami went that way, and they were able to win championships. Whether or not that was a key factor of them winning is not really the point. It's because they had the best player in the world. But for the Thunder, they have more to prove because they haven't been there yet. And I think that's a tale of two theories, whether it's drafting guys and trying to teach them how to be that type of role player, like they're trying to do there with Steven Adams and Jeremy Lamb and Perry Jones III, or do you just try to find guys out in the open market and say, hey, can you come in and be a leader?
Well, there's a difference, with the free agents, you have to overpay to get them to leave their current situation.
Sometimes.
I'm going to say more often than not. Are going to go for the best deal as opposed to, I'm in a good
situation.
You're not poaching people from bad teams. You're okay, like Isaiah Thomas. Oh, he was doing good. Okay, we're going to give him $28 million to come in. Okay, you overpaid a little to so he'd leave Sacramento. And in drafting, they're a lot cheaper. And people forget how bad the Sonics were, because Westbrook, I think, was the fourth overall pick. Durant, as we know, was the second overall pick. Harden was the third overall pick. So in three consecutive years, your teams got awful.
They were
awful.
And
then, this is the old why tanking doesn't seem to work, is because you draft all these young players and you can't pay them all.
You remember who the head coach was when they first when Durant first got there?
Oh, no.
PJ Carlissimo. He had been the assistant with the Spurs, and Presti came from San Antonio originally, so he wanted to bring in a guy that he knew. Brought in Carlissimo. It didn't last long though. By the middle of the 2008 of 2009 season, like in late 2008. Clay Bennett already showed his hand that he wanted to win now, and he got rid of Carlissimo, and he put in Scotty Brooks, who was just an assistant there, and now he's the head man. I mean, you and I have gone back and forth about how we are not big fans of Scotty Brooks. Another former Sonic, and another guy that we were talking about, hired guns, guys that took less to win, Ray Allen, he has announced he is not going to play this season. He kind of left the door open in his quotes that he might come back, but I don't think he's coming back. Do you think he's coming back?
let's have an announcement where you can announce he's not coming back next year, or the year after, the year after.
It kind of feels like Karl Malone. You remember when Karl Malone didn't really retire at first? He just kind of hung it out there, and then in April of 2005, he signed a one-day deal with the Jazz and retired. It kind of feels that way with Ray Allen. It kind of feels like he was just kind of hanging out there just to see and try to gauge the interest, and maybe he tried to work his way into it in the month of January, and his body wasn't there. You know, Reggie Miller said that. You know, Danny Ainge tried to get him to go play for the Celtics in 2007, the year that they won the title, but he couldn't get his body back right, and he said, okay, I can't do this.
Yeah, but that's him trying, and Jermaine O'Neal tried and couldn't get his body back. Ray Allen just seems like, I'm not taking the minimum. Who's going to want me? Who's going to want me? Well, we want you, but all we have is the minimum. Oh, well, maybe I'll just sit out this year and we'll see how next year go. He just seems not like he's trying now.
So you think, and we're going to transition this into the next segment. You think that might be a byproduct of the fact that he might be able to make more money for his services down the road if he waits it out?
That's what it seems like, because, you know, he whined his way out of Boston. Miami, it didn't seem like they were so happy as they made it believe. Mm-hmm. He seemed a little whinier then, and, you know, it just seems like, oh, he's going to go to Cleveland. I might go to Cleveland. Let's see what their cap room, you know.
Yeah.
It just seems like, you know, if you want to play, you'll play. There are people who, you know, are like, you always like, oh man, I wish I could have played one or two more years. My body broke down. He's just like, I'm going to take a year off.
Yeah, but he deserves that. I mean, he's a Hall of Fame guy. He's made Hall of Fame plays down the stretch of games. I think he's a guy that you might want to make that room for in the playoffs. But the problem with Ray Allen is that I think he was so good at not showing his hand to what team he wanted to play for that no teams really left room on the table for him in case he wanted to come back. And by the time he had interest, it was too late. Nobody had enough cap room to give him a good deal, or even, to be honest with you, enough minutes under the rotation to put him in.
It's just a game of musical chairs. And
well, you know, we've seen guys in the D League come up, or maybe like a veteran come in on a 10-day deal and wind up on the postseason roster and make an impact. You know, it happened with Troy Daniels for the Houston Rockets last year. I remember it happened with Rafer Alston with the Orlando Magic. I mean, I think Ray Allen could have done that, but it would have been tough. It would have been tough to be able to find him minutes like just right off of the street.
Yeah. That's just, you know, like I said, it just seems more personality-based to me than – again, all I have to base it on is just his words and Jermaine O'Neal's. Like, Jermaine's like, I'm trying. My body just can't do it. I'm too old. I'm broken down. Ray's like, I heard my name's in the paper today. I just Google alert myself, and my name pops up in some rumors. I'll check it out. Awesome. Oh, you know, Golden State, they're interesting. Go Cleveland. Oh, maybe Miami. Oh.
So you're saying Ray Allen is basically every professional wrestler in the business, reading the dirt sheets. It's like, where am I going to go today? Oh, I guess I'm going to the Warriors today. Before we get into like kind of the more of a macro issue, and I think we'll finish that one off as our final issue, because I think we can kind of really delve into that talking about the luxury tax and such. Let's talk a little bit about the Denver Nuggets, because even though we talked about how there weren't really many big happenings this week, there was one, even though some people expected it, and that was the firing of Brian Shaw, who was an assistant coach. He was obviously a player under Phil Jackson with the LA Lakers, became his assistant in LA, did a very good job. They won two titles when he was an assistant there. He left there after Phil retired and became an assistant for the Indiana Pacers underneath Frank Vogel. Did a pretty good job there, and he took over as the head coach of the Denver Nuggets in 2013 when George Karl, who had just won the freaking Coach of the Year award, got fired. And so he took over a situation where he had good talent, but no one really believed he could pull off what George Karl pulled off, and the doubters were proven right. So let's just kind of get it all started. What do you think went wrong, per se, with the Denver Nuggets?
Well, first, let me just sidestep, even before getting into the issue. What does this really say about Phil Jackson's triangle? Because who has really been successful in implementing it so far?
Well, Tex Winter never left Phil's side, so he's a bad example because he was the architect of the triangle when he was at Kansas State. And also a couple of other pro teams, but he was kind of like the whisperer for Phil when it came to running the triangle in Chicago and LA. There was Jim Clemens. Now, Jim Clemens was the coach of the Dallas Mavericks in the 90s. He did a terrible job, just like any player or any coach that was there in Dallas around that time would have done anyway. And he got the axe very quickly. I'm trying to think of a couple of other assistants that got
Kurt
chances.
Rambis in Minnesota.
You're right.
Fisher.
Well, Derek Fisher is just starting there. So.
I know. This is, you know, okay, it's, you know, year one at him, but it's not really doing too good for him. Mm-hmm. You know, Steve Kerr has abandoned it as quick as he possibly could.
Well, I don't know. Kerr, they run a little bit of triangle sometimes, but it's more of like a distraction or a decoy for the main move. And also, you got to remember, too, Steve Kerr is a great sponge because he played underneath Phil Jackson. He played underneath Greg Popovich, so he was able to take in all that knowledge or as much as he could while he played there. And he was the general manager of the Suns when they had Steve Nash and Amari Stoudemire when they ran that really fast tempo offense. So he's got a lot of different – he's worn a lot of different hats, and he's learned a lot of different things. And he's done a great job of implementing the parts that he likes and downplaying the parts that he didn't like. With the triangle – it is what it is, and you run the same system over and over again. It's all about execution, and it's all about communicating. And that Knicks team, they don't communicate, or are they good? I mean, they're neither.
So, yeah, they're neither, and you know, but that, like I said, that's just year one. But Derek Fisher, he's not off to a good start. And the last one on the list is Bill Cartwright.
Oh, with the Bulls. I mean,
yeah.
Watch that Bulls team. My God, I mean, that team was garbage. They had no chance.
It was garbage, but he didn't really help his cause. And, you know, Brian Shaw, Denver failed because that was George Karl's team. George Karl wants to run up and down. You have Shaw coming and going, no, let's just stop and play defense. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happened to Kurt Rambis is, I'm coaching this way. Well, your players can't do what you want to do. No, the players will play how I want them to play. And then the day you get fired, they all have a party and start winning.
Well, you heard the 1-2-3 6 week story where they would do the huddle and they would say 6 weeks. Now, they claim that they meant 6 weeks as for – I can't remember what they said.
Last time they won at home.
The last time they won at home, but everybody knew what it meant, that there were 6 weeks left until the regular season was over, which gave the feeling that they were just – they were really going through the motions and they just were ready for the season to end. You know – a lot of times with players on a team, you know, I remember this happened with John Kuster in Detroit where the team sort of had a mini revolt and they wouldn't go to practice sessions. And I think kind of the linchpin for that was Rip Hamilton because he was a veteran there. He didn't really respect Kuster, and it showed because of the fact that they walked out on him. We don't know the inside stories. Only the beat writers in Denver do. But do you think there was really one guy that really kind of you can point to and say, well, because of him not communicating with the coach, the team sort of swayed the other way? Or do you think it was one of these things where the entire team just tuned out on him?
It just seemed like the entire team tuned out. And you have, like, you know, the stories like, oh, they're immature. There's no leaders in the locker room. And Ty Lawson was like, eh, I guess you're right. It's not really, you know, if he's just sort of throwing up his hands going, you know, it is what it is. We didn't play for him. He didn't want to coach us. We didn't want to – nobody was happy. And
well, that's a good point because they don't really have a star player. Now, a star player comes in and says, I don't like this guy. Well, that's different because the team will turn where the star player goes, not the head coach. It always has been that way because the star player is the most respected player in the locker room. Always has been, always will be. And so – If the coach is not in tune with the star player, that can cause a rift. With Denver, they do have Ty Lawson. Daniil Gallinari used to be a really good player, but they don't really have that one guy that they respect and that they listen to and that they will follow his trail if he goes one direction or another. And with Denver, they don't have one. So when everything started going awry, they had no one to turn to in the locker room.
Well, they just had no veteran presence, period.
Mm-hmm.
you know, we, again, they were just built on potential. We did our previews and we're like, well, okay, they got rattled with injuries. If they could come back, and then you're like, well, what happened to Kenneth Faried? He was supposed to be running up and down in this crazy, you know, energy guy. Well, where's his energy? He's just sitting doing nothing. It's like, well, that's not a good sign.
What does it say to you, though, that underneath the new head coach, Melvin Hunt, who I really don't know much about, that they've actually played a lot better than they have in the last month or so? Do you think it's sort of like a slap in the face of Brian Shaw trying to say, hey, we could do this without you. We never needed you.
Well, I had asked you because, you know, I asked you earlier, you know, I didn't know. I haven't really been up on Denver these past few weeks. So
nobody
for all I, for all I know, they could just be playing a more style that actually fits the team. And just by default, you're playing better if you're playing to your strengths.
Well, you know, that almost speaks to the culture of the Nuggets organization since, God, since they've been in the ABA. Because you remember under Doug Moe, they were an up-tempo team with Alex English and Fat Lever. And I think Kiki Vandeweghe was on that team for a little while. And they were and Dan Issel. And they always pushed the ball. The only team that I remember didn't really push the ball in Denver was the one with Dan Issel coached. When they had, like, Dikembe Mutombo.
Well, because you can't push with Dikembe, period.
And Robert Pack and formerly Chris Jackson, Mamadou Maou-Raouf. And then they had that. Then after that, they went back to the kind of their running-gunning ways when they had George Karl, Chauncey Billups, Carmelo Anthony, Lawson as a rookie, and J.R. Smith. Yeah, and they went to the Western Conference Finals. Even after trading Carmelo, they pushed the tempo again with Gallinari and JaVale McGee, and they did well there, but they just couldn't get over the hump of getting out of the first round, and that's what cost Karl his job. And maybe it's the fact that Brian Shaw was kind of fighting against history and saying, I'm going to do things my way, you know, roster be damned, because it was a roster that was definitely built to push the ball and to play at a quick tempo. When you have Ty Lawson on your team, you need to play fast because that's really his strength. And yeah. Randy Foy, too. So when they went away from that, it seemed like they were kind of going against the grain and the players just did not respond well to it. I felt that from the moment Shaw took over there.
Yeah, it just, like, you know, we always, every week, it's like, well, what's going on with Denver? Shouldn't they be turning the corner now? They really can't be this bad, can they?
I don't think they're that bad.
Like, they just look uninspired, and, you know, you look at that roster, it's just like, well, you know, is there something really wrong with Gallinari?
Like, who's a more talented team, the Denver Nuggets or the Phoenix Suns? The Denver Nuggets. Like, they got Gallinari, they got J.J. Hickson, they've got Lawson, they've got Kenneth Faried. I mean, they've got good players on their team. And, I mean, Phoenix has maybe, like, what, two good players? Like, two really good players? You know, Denver's got, like, two of them of their own.
Phoenix has role players. They have, you know, the interchangeable Morris twins.
And they have a coach that they listen to.
They have a coach they listen to. It's just like, Denver is just a team where, they seem to be just put together of people you had to overpay to sort of get. Like Wilson Chandler, he's good. Well, we signed him to a deal a little higher than we should have, but he's here now. Mm-hmm. You know, Gallinari, yeah, I know they both came in the trade, but they're players who don't fit a system. Hickson, he was great in, was it Sacramento, I think?
Which one? Who's
J.J. Hickson.
Hickson was in Cleveland for a little while.
Okay, Cleveland. Because, like, once he just disappeared. He was supposed to be the high motor guy and, you know, just that lean center. And their team has nothing slow down written about them.
Yeah, that's the thing. I don't think Shaw was trying to play slow, but it seemed like he was sort of dictating that style more and more in practice. Because it seemed like they were deliberately playing slow on the offensive end. It was almost like the players were showing, you see, this doesn't work. And, you know, my whole point of the discussion is that, do you think players can play within a system despite their coach? Do you think that they can do everything that the coach asked them to do after the coach leaves just to prove them wrong? I think these players are smarter than people think. And I think they know all the plays and they know how to run them, but it's just about, it's all a matter of effort and it's a matter of commitment. And
well, I think, of course, you know, I'm just going to interrupt you right there, but these kids have been running the exact same plays since they were 13. Mm-hmm. They've been doing it, you know, for 15 years now. It's not like they're learning some new concepts they've never heard of before. And what is, you know, it's just a lot of, I don't know whether it's just sort of an attitude like prima donna thing in Denver, thinking they better they are, or just the coach just was really just abrasive and didn't know how to talk to the team or whatnot. But, you know, it's just I don't think it's just a big F you to the coach, because you don't start a season and go into the week going, oh, man, I totally want to be miserable today. I don't want to come to practice. I don't want to go to work. I hate my job. I hate basketball. Basketball is the only thing I know how to do. And the passion has been, the joy has been sucked out.
Yeah. Like Larry Sanders, but that his situation was more of a mental condition, not as much as I'm lazy and I don't want to play anymore.
Like Andrew Bynum, just
Andrew Bynum is just a case of the lazies, you know.
Yeah, so I don't think it's just a big F you, like, oh yeah, I'm going to start playing now, screw him. It's just sort of like, yeah, you didn't listen to our input, you didn't value us as your players, you kept thinking you know better than us.
Yeah.
Here's what we can do if you let us be free for a minute.
It really kicks in when the value of the player as an individual sinks in the marketplace based on the production. That's when the urgency kicks in. That's why we have so many good performances for players in contract years, obviously. You know, okay, I need to play for a new deal. I got to show what I can do. But I feel like these players, they wait a little too long to put forth their best effort, because they think that just because you play good in the last 2 months of the season in your contract year, and that you could just make up a good deal all of a sudden. And, you know, I don't think GMs are that stupid, but GMs in the NBA do pretty stupid things. So maybe I'm wrong.
They do stupid things more, I would say, as we could say, you know, he's a, you know, reclamation project. We could save him. Mm-hmm. You know,
he's a bad fit here. He'll be a good fit.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I was talking a little bit about how I think the players obviously are smarter in terms of kind of mental know-how on how to play the game and how to run sets and how to do what the coach says, that they know how to do it. It's just a matter of commitment. But we did have a couple of really funny mental gaffes in pivotal moments of two games. One of them was between the Wizards and the Bulls. The Wizards, like we were talking, are going a little bit backwards. One of the reasons is because one guy didn't move at all, and that was Otto Porter. He was on a corner. It was on a spot where I think was it Mirotić? It was Mirotić on the corner, and Otto Porter was guarding him on the last second play. And what happened is Mirotić curls around, you know, kind of like the old Ray Allen around the world type of screen, and Otto Porter does nothing.
He just sat there waiting for the play to start. And
it was a greatest hits immediately on Vine and Twitter. And then we had another one with DeAndre Jordan, the center for the L.A. Clippers, who has been playing well. So I want to give him a little credit before we douse him. And that was that I can't remember the team that they played against, but the game basically went into overtime because Chris Paul lofted up a shot. And then on a putback, because it was a shot clock violation, but what happened is it was they thought it was a play on off the rim. And DeAndre Jordan just sat there with the ball.
With 2 seconds left.
And finish. And Chris Paul went ballistic, screaming at DeAndre Jordan, put it in, put it in, put it in, even though it didn't matter anyway because it was a shot clock violation. But it's just a matter that he quit on the play when there's still time left on the freaking clock.
Well, that was like, you know, like, remember, like, in football, just Randy Moss would run plays when he felt like it. Or
alligator arms, yeah.
Yeah, just a lot of that, but
we see a lot of alligator arms in basketball. I mean, good Lord, how many people quit on defensive assignments because they know they got beat? I mean, it happens a lot.
Yeah, it's just, you know, the thing about basketball is, all right, I'll give up two. I know I'll get the ball back. I'll just hit a three. You know, it's all good. I can make the shot. With Otto Porter, I don't think nobody's calling him a, you know, basketball high IQ player. He's just, you know, I guess he was just lucky to be on the court at that point. But, you know, everybody, the problem is the NBA is, okay, your stuff's all on TV, millions of people see it, we've all done stupid shit like that. And
yeah, I mean, and there used to be that Follies video for the NBA, You know, they had them all the time anyway for the NFL. I used to rent those at the video store and have a good laugh with my dad. But with the NBA, obviously, there's always a lot of funny moments. There's even a compilation called Shaqt and a Fool where Shaquille O'Neal will just sit here and just laugh his ass off at all these stupid mistakes that people, that players make. But my question is this, why do things like that happen? Like, why is it that at a pivotal – do you think players just get bored with the 82-game season and they sort of kind of desensitize to all the vital information and they just kind of space out? Like, why does that happen in the most important parts of games?
They're two separate plays. First, the DeAndre Jordan was like, all right, it's overtime. I know we're going to overtime. You know we're going to overtime. Well, let's just get there. You know, not playing the final one. But Otto Porter was just sort of more of trying to think too far ahead and – you know, because this was right after a timeout, so they had probably went over the next play or two to run out of the, you know, when they get the ball back. So he was thinking of...
But you know what's dumb about it with Porter is that it's not like he's looking away at the ball handler. He is looking right at the player in front of him. It's almost like he's just kind of thinking to himself, but you know how you have one of those moments where you're in a crowd and you're kind of looking and gazing and the other person's looking at you weird thinking you're staring at him, but you're not really, you know, one of those weird interactions. It's kind of like that where he's looking at him, but he's not really thinking about what's going on, you know?
Yeah, it's just one of the, your mind is elsewhere and
daydreaming, I guess.
Yeah, just daydreaming or just watching the people in the crowd or just thinking about something else. And, oh, shit, my guy's on the other side of the
floor. Now, let's say this. Like, usually in 80s and 90s basketball, people would usually, because we didn't have social media and all these different technologies where we could pick apart every little play and every little intricate moment – there's a good chance that people would have never seen that, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. But because our eyeballs are so firm on mistakes and gaffes like that, even something like that is pretty noticeable. And within a matter of days, I was watching things like Otto Porter watching a glacier go by.
Well, yeah, that's the funny thing is, like, okay, let's say 20 years ago, you would see it on your NBA Follies tape, and that would be it. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago, you'd just see it on SportsCenter, not top plays, and it would go against, you know, the butt fumble or something for a top play. Like, then you wouldn't forget. But now it's just Vine and the interwebs. It's just going to keep living on till the next stupid play.
And they can find every little thing and say, oh, look at this mistake he made, you know?
Exactly. And it's just, you know, too much information available, too much data, you know, one bad play and all of a sudden, okay, yes, the videos are funny, but at the same point, you know, he moved on the next play. We should just all move on and have our laugh. And
we had our laugh. And speaking of too much data, I think this issue is going to be kind of fitting for that, for that discussion, but we're going to kind of hit on it. You wanted to ask a little bit about the salary cap and the potential for the salary cap growth going into the 2015-16 season, which is 2 years down the road.
You sure we have time for that this episode?
I think we could squeeze it.
Okay. Well, with this massive cap cash influx coming in, is basketball going to be dead in 2 to 3 years?
The game of basketball.
The game of basketball, the competitiveness, because the bad teams will never get better because everybody has max deals available. Everybody can now sign two or three players and have their superstar team. You know, with Dragic going, my top choices are New York, L.A., and Miami. It's like, why would you – New York and L.A. have nobody. Why would you want to go to that team? And it's just, well, oh, that's the big market. So who's not going to, you know, New Orleans will offer Anthony Davis a big deal, a max deal. Well, yeah, so will L.A. And they'll be like, well, we could offer you Hollywood stuff too. And at what point can Milwaukee and Oklahoma City and New Orleans keep up with it?
Well, that's the way the NBA has always been. It's always been predicated on the top markets. It's always been predicated on very few franchises winning championships and being competitive for championships at one time. That's why we've had so few franchises win NBA championships since 1980. You know, I think there's only been 9 of them or maybe 10 so far that have won championships.
There's a difference between championships and having superstars. Like, will you see a Ray Allen in Milwaukee? Will you see a – I can't even think of anyone else right now.
If you draft well, yes, you will see those players. And if you can buy them into staying and building a competitor there, you can. But
how can you buy them into staying if you can't get – the B and C pieces because
I get what you're saying. Is it harder if the bigger teams that have a little bit more money to throw around going into the expanded salary cap, if they have more money to throw around and they can add more players and convince them to win with them, is it going to be harder for those smaller market teams to keep their star players? Yeah, but it's always been hard for the smaller market teams to keep their players. I think that goes with the territory. You know, I'm here in New Orleans with the Pelicans. That's something that we just have to deal with. We dealt with it with Baron Davis. We dealt with it already with Chris Paul. It just goes with the territory. I think this is more cyclical than it is. Is this the end of basketball? You know, I don't think business will ever kill any professional sport. The sports will continue to play regardless. Whether or not it's going to affect the makeup of the rosters at the top and how much more competitive and how much better they're going to be than the bottom teams, I think that we might see some separation, some really clear separation there going into, you know, the 2016, 2017, 2018. I think in the short term, we're going to see some teams at the top that are going to be really, really good because they're going to have that extra money to go around. And remember, Adam, a lot of these contracts that are in play now and going into 2015, those are going to be contracts based on the older salary cap, which maxes out with a luxury tax at $76.8 million. So you're going to have these lower salaries, per se, in the new collective bargaining agreement going forward. So it looks like a bargain. But the reason why I think it's going to be short term is because sooner or later, once we get to 2017, 2018, the market is going to balance out and all these star players are going to be signing up for $25 to $30 million contracts anyway.
Well, yeah, it'll be, like I said, the next 2 or 3 years. But, like, look, remember the Clippers back in the 90s when they were just god-awful? The players would just come there for 4 years knowing they're going to leave and just waiting for their 4 years to get their better contract and mm-hmm. – the fans stopped coming. Like, what would, you know, let's say New Orleans, okay, you lose Anthony Davis, you lose everybody. Why would you want to go to a game? Why would you just become, the disparity would be so great. That's sort of my, you know, reasoning of now you could, you know, pick, you know, the second, third players off teams.
And, well, the advantage of the money being on equal revenue sharing is that, I guess you could call it equal in some ways, is that the rich get richer, but the poor get richer too. You know, it's not like the poor get poorer. It's not like they're losing all this money and all the big teams are squeezing out their revenue and not giving back. The smaller teams are going to make their money too. When they sell their franchises and get new owners, they're going to sell theirs for over $1 billion probably as well. And also, I think another important piece is that there are so many good, young, talented players in the NBA now compared to the last two lockouts that we had. Well, not this one in 2012. I'm talking more about 1999 and 2005 when they had their collective bargaining agreements. And I didn't feel like the talent level in the NBA as a whole was very good. So it was much harder for those lower-level teams to be competitive, whereas now I think there's a little bit more leeway for those bottom teams to rise. Now, how far do they rise is different because we just talked about how few franchises have won championships. It's going to be hard for those other teams like Milwaukee, Toronto, Washington, Houston even. It's going to be hard for those teams to rise up and win championships because regardless of how much talent you have, you're still just another team. You know, and you can't fight that off regardless of how much money you have or how much cap space you keep. And let's be honest, look at the New York Yankees with that ridiculous revenue sharing model that they have in Major League Baseball where they can spend $300 million. Just because you spend a lot of money doesn't mean you're going to win championships.
Oh, yeah. But at the same time, you have just teams like Houston Astros, who are just god awful and will continue to be god awful. And you see empty arenas, and they could sell it for millions, but
because you can hide behind the 50-50 revenue sharing, and you can overpay players and still make your money back. Whereas in the NBA, you have a minimum. You have a minimum amount to spend. That's why the Philadelphia 76ers still had to overpay some people like Jason Richardson in order to keep their books balanced so that it doesn't look like they're tanking on the business side of things. They're only tanking on the court. You know, so you got to spend money to make headway no matter how good or how bad you are. You know, can you be made fun of for spending a lot of money on players that aren't worth the shit? For sure. I mean, this is what a podcast like this is for. But it's just the point that sooner or later the salaries are gonna balloon along with the salary cap. But I think the big question is how long is it gonna take to do that? And this is the unanswered question that's gonna be influencing all of this. How long is it gonna be until Adam Silver and Michelle Roberts, who's the leader of the players union now, when they get into their collective bargaining agreement in 2016? How are they going to implement that new increase in revenue from the television contract, and how quickly is that money going to be available? Because that's going to directly influence how much money is going to be spent and how much money they can throw at other players to come play for them.
Well, that'll just be the biggest influence of whether there'll be a lockout or a strike, and then
I think there will be a very short lockout. That's
That's going to kill everything they have going for it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's very, you know, like I said, interesting topics I just thought of.
Why do you think it might kill the sport? Like, why do you think it might kill the model, the league model?
Well, because now everybody, you know, it's well known how much money you're getting with this TV contract, and now they're bitching about, you know, the money not being distributed evenly. And
well, that was the complaint of the owners in 2011. They said, well, we're not making money, but we're not going to show you our books. And it's like, well, you just showed your books to the new investor of your team, like the Milwaukee Bucks and the LA Clippers, and you just fucking doubled your value. And you're telling me that you're getting poorer? You know, the players are saying, please, you know, spare me.
Yeah, it's – but it's just nowadays, especially with this past strike, and it seems like they're just going every 5 years for having a new strike. It's just they're not helping their cause right now.
Mm-hmm.
In this, you know, new future golden age, and I don't know.
I think we're in a golden age, but they need to be careful with the new money that's going to be driven into the league for the next 2 years, because it seems like things are starting to circulate around that year, sort of the way it did in 2011 when the lockout came, because people are just waiting to see what kind of money they can make. That's why LeBron signed that deal. That's why Dwight Howard signed that deal. His contract expires at the same time too. Kevin Durant the same. And I don't think that – I think as good as they are, and has – no matter how loyal they say they are to the teams that they're playing for, they're not stupid. I mean, they're going to make every red cent they can get. I mean, there was the news that just came out about Peyton Manning and how they had to – him and the Denver Broncos had to fight for every red cent so that Peyton Manning didn't feel cheapened out for cutting his contract salary. I mean, these players, regardless of how great they are and how loyal they say they are, they want every bit of money they can squeeze out of that team.
Well, yeah, they want every bit of money for themselves, not for – like, Dwight Howard doesn't care about Corey Brewer and what his contract will be, or...
No, of course
Terrence not. Jones?
Does he care about him, like, helping him get better and helping him win a championship? Absolutely. You know, maybe they're not best friends in the locker room, but they don't have to be in order to play well as a team. When it's business, it's business. You know, it's just the way it is. They're going to make their deals, and if that means they have to depart, then so be it. Look, I mean, we're talking about football again. Look at the Patriots. Look at how many players they've lost over the last 2 weeks. I mean, you can't keep those teams together, the NFL. The difference in the NFL and the NBA is that the NBA's cap is a little softer than the NFL's. The NFL's salary cap is almost like jail.
NFL is just a complete mystery with signing bonuses versus
incentives
versus guaranteed pay, and
yes.
Nobody ever sees their real contract, and it's just all fake numbers. And
every cut line becomes this like this frantic deadline to get rid of either dead weight or good players because of the fact that you can't afford them, or you don't want to feel the penalty from being over the cap. You know, being over the cap in the NBA is okay, even though the luxury tax has doubled or tripled compared to the previous years. But if you're over the cap in the NFL, I mean, it's like you need to go to a fucking committee.
Well, everybody's over the cap in the NFL after like
yeah, but
every
not,
year.
By what? A dollar? A fucking cookie bar?
It's just well, what incentives hit? I don't know. We need to all stop and take a week and figure out who did what to what our cap is. Whereas the salary cap of the NBA, I don't think outside of Philly any team is under the actual salary cap itself. Mm-hmm. It's just the most arbitrary number that no one everyone's worried about the luxury tax line, and that should just be the salary cap line.
We'll turn this around with the NFL and NBA. Remember how they had the rumors that they might play without a salary cap? Or maybe they did they? One season?
NFL?
Yeah, they had 1 year where they may have played.
They had 1 year, and that's the year Dallas and Washington got penalized
because
they weren't
sure what the new salary cap was going to be. And once it was re-implemented, they said, well, you were over the cap, you get punished.
Yeah, you know? And that was like, well, you didn't say, well, you guys just blatantly, you know. Everyone else tried to play within the rules and be kind of nice. You guys just didn't give a shit.
Do you see a similar situation where people will overspend now because they're going to be able to get – they're going to anticipate that new money. They just don't know how quick the money will come. So they'll take the chance and say, all right, then we'll go from $76.8 million to like $90 million. And if we end up having to pay $5 million into the tax on the new deal, so be it. Do you think any owner would take that chance, or do you think that's just way too much lost money?
It depends on the team. If your team is 1 year away and has a very tiny window, you sort of have to go for that.
The Clippers.
The Clippers have nothing. They
like say the Clippers come in and say, I'm trying to think of a big time free agent next season.
It's going
to
be DeAndre Jordan.
Well, no, I'm talking about like say they keep their roster and they sign. I'll just give you as kind of like a hypothetical, Kevin Durant. And they say, hey, Durant, we'll bring you in for your full salary, even if it means we have to go to $90 million on the luxury tax, because we know that down the road, that salary cap is going to go up to $88 million, and we're only going to be a couple million over the salary cap in the new collective bargaining agreement.
Yeah, it'll all even out.
Exactly. But do you think that they would actually – do you think any owner would be willing to pay that much in the short term – because they know that the money will balance out later.
Well, Brooklyn tried that. There's always going to be one owner. Mark Cuban always used to be a overspender and give, $60 million deals to Rafe LaFrentz and
yes.
Brendan Haywood. And so that's going to be the problem is you're going to have people like, you're going to see the new Jerome Jameses get $20 million and the Mark Blounts and the
– I don't miss those days. I don't miss those days where Eddie Curry got $50 million.
Yeah, and that's what's going to happen is you're going to start seeing bad players getting huge deals. Yeah.
Yeah, where they would say, well, I'll take you for this if they don't want you for that. And then also it becomes a rat race between the agents and the owners because the owners are trying to push all these players to sign their deals now because – and this is the trick. They want to get them underneath the current cap situation so that they become bargain deals in the new deal. And the agents are telling them to push and wait so that they can make the big money based on the new economic model. But then there are the players that say, fuck it, I want my money now. Like Tobias Harris, does he wait another year and then he gets more money based on that deal, or he just says, you know what, I'll take my chance of restricted free agency now and I'll sign my money because I want to get paid.
I'll get my deal now because who knows what can happen. There can be, the money could be out there, but there might be, there's not going to be enough roster spots for everybody, and you can't sign 12 max guys, and you still need, draft picks and filling out the rosters, and a Tobias Harris won't fit on half the teams anyways, but just because they have the money.
Yeah.
You're not going to be, he's an up-tempo guy. Well, we're a slowdown team, but we got the money. Fuck it. Let's go get him.
Yeah. We don't know what's going to happen there, but we do know what's going to happen right now, and that's how we're ending the show. And it was a good one. We got to talk about salary cap, try to catch up on the regular season a little bit. Any other takeaways before we get out of here?
Hopefully next week it's just not the same horrible teams being horrible and You know, let's maybe Washington could win a couple games.
Yeah, maybe Washington, maybe Toronto. We need winners. We're like Mike Singletary. We need winners. All right, on behalf of Adam Murray, this is Andrew Reich. Keep winning, guys.